This week in Palestine offers news from a Palestinian perspective. The following hour may contain views that do not necessarily reflect those of WZBC, Boston College, or its Board of Trustees.
You're listening to This Week in Palestine. I'm your host, Ann Lucas. Sabah al-khair, masa al-khair, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. You are listening to This Week in Palestine, and I'm your host, Ann Lucas. On December 2nd, 2024, Ta-Nehisi Coates was at Rutgers University. And while there, he sat down for a discussion with Palestinian human rights scholar, Professor Nora Erekat. Coates has been on a book tour promoting his new book, The Message. He has long been a thinker of note on the question of true African-American liberation, but in The Message, he found himself turning almost half the book over to the question of Palestinian liberation. His formal book tour interviews have ranged from downright racist to rather rude to a bit confused. But at Rutgers, he found himself among a community committed to truth, and thus could speak openly and extensively on the question of Palestinian liberation and the role of observers like him in confronting Palestinian apartheid. Nora Erekat has been on this show before. She's a preeminent voice, and for me, a guiding light, on the legal questions surrounding Palestine and the genocide in Gaza. But more than someone who is just well-schooled in international law, she is Palestinian and a human being seeing what we have been seeing in Gaza. She is outraged and heartbroken all at once, just like the rest of us. So this conversation is a fascinating meeting of both minds and hearts to discuss the role of writers in pursuits of social justice, both Black and Palestinian. The connection between these two battles for liberation is a key theme, and the overall conversation is both illuminating and expansive. I don't want to take up much more time, so you have more time with Coates and Erekat. So yalla bina, let's go.
For you to set the stage for us of why, what is the mandate of the writer? And how does that mandate bring us to this book? And specifically what you write in the book is that a writer is supposed to save the world. And you come to that realization in your love of American football. And your encounter of witnessing violence and then realizing that sometimes it wins. And then many times in your world, it was winning. And then writing becomes the way to combat it. And so it sets the stage. Yeah.
Well, first of all, thank you guys for having me. I really didn't teach at Howard while I was working on this book. And so it's always good to, you know, be back and see young people, some of whom I hope themselves have ambitions for being writers. I say that because that's the way this book took shape and the way it's written. It is written to and for young people. Wow, is there like some sort of mic? How does that work?
That's the mic, that bar. We don't hear it, they hear it.
That is incredible. Wow.
Yes, Rutgers.
I'm used to this whole thing. Wow, no, this is incredible. This whole thing where they gotta wire you up. Or, you know, y'all just put a bar down. Wow, I can speak. So I can speak normally. I don't have to do the whole thing. I was like, man, ain't no mic in here. So it was written, you know, because I have spent a good portion actually of my writing career teaching writing and over the past 10 years or so teaching, you know, really young writers. And oftentimes we are faced with this question, particularly in an era where Silicon Valley is king and STEM is king and, you know, we need to teach girls to code and why are you, you know, wasting your time being a poetry major? That the responsibility, the skills, the utility of speaking clearly about the world as it is in front of us is paramount and essential to any sort of political change. That there cannot be political change if you can't see things clearly. And that is principally the job of writing, or it should be. Some people who write do not take that as their ambition, but in its best form, the writing that lives, I think the writing that probably most people in this room honor, and certainly the writing that is that constructs the tradition that I come out of, is to clarify the world. It is not simply to write beautifully for the hell of writing beautifully. I like beautiful writing like anybody else, but that writing has to, you know, when it's at its strongest, when it's at its most urgent, when it's at its most commanding, it is connected to some larger thing. And we are living in a time wherein I don't have to go down the list and recite, you know, the challenges. But I don't think any of us in our particular vocations has the luxury of just, you know, doing something for the sheer pleasure of it. The world does need saving. And what there is to be saved can't be saved if it can't be clarified. And that is the central job of writing.
So aside from the fact that you didn't think I was a young person you were speaking to.
We'll talk later.
Okay. But this desire for you to clarify the world, which is so clear in itself. It's so clear in itself how that becomes distilled. But that helped you map out an itinerary that took you to the African continent for the first time.
First time ever.
That took you to South Carolina.
Not for the first time ever.
But where probably you could travel, but your book couldn't.
That's true.
Right?
Or at least not in the same way. Yes, that's definitely true.
And then took you to Palestine.
Yes.
So what strings together that itinerary?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest with you, you know, when I start writing a book, I never quite know what I'm doing. You know, it usually starts with some sort of emotional desire, and then you're trying to, you know, fill it together. And I actually had a number of places that I was going to go. I mean, mm-hmm. San Francisco was on the list. Buffalo was on the list. Actually, Queens, New York was on the list. And then as you work on it, things just kind of boil down into, okay, I think this is how, you know, things connect. And so in Senegal and Dakar, it was confronting the real source or the place, I hate calling it the source, but I guess in many ways it is, the source of anti-blackness and white supremacy and the myth and the narratives that have been created and you know, employed in movies and in literature that is the backbone of white supremacy in this country and anti-black racism in this country. In South Carolina, to see the stories of, you know, people who, I don't know, executed that system of white supremacy, one might say, and how they are exalted to this very day and the impact that they have to this very day. And then, you know, to Palestine, you know, to see that same story of white supremacy globalized, you know, and how a very brutal system, at the end of the day, cannot function without narrative. And that's like one of the, you know, the key insights of the book, that people rarely say, you have something that I covet, and so I'm going to take it from you because I'm evil. They usually construct some sort of narrative in which they are heroic. They are prevailing against all odds. They somehow are, you know, the victim turned hero, and they are just and correct and right in what they're doing. This is a commonality among oppressive systems. And it's so common that it really led me to the conclusion that as much as we pay attention to the material and as much as we should pay attention to the material, crafting the story is crucial. Human beings are not wired in such a way to just go around and rob people without telling stories about why that robbery is just. And that is, you know, one of the arguments of the message.
So there's a lot in there. There's a lot in there, and I want to get to all of it, but I kind of want to start with you, which is the story that you believe, the very same story that you're going after, right? Mm-hmm. But it's the story that also forms almost the heart of, I just realized, the case for reparations in the Atlantic, which you all are familiar with, many of us teach it, And as one of the characters says, it's okay, you're not perfect. But the story therein, in the case for reparations, is your belief in a story that was told about Israel. And so who are you then listening to that story, and what pulls you out of it to even look for a different story? Most people don't look for different stories.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think I should just take it from the basis of what journalism in my mind is supposed to be. Right? And it is supposed to be, there are people who believe that you write stories for other people, right? Like you go, oh, I think this is a cool story. I already know it. I shall record it and recite it, put it down on paper, and then you shall consume it. But when I was young, one of the things I noticed is that I was always the most excited and the most intense when there was something I did not actually understand myself. And that the story was the manifestation of my attempt to reach some sort of understanding. And then I slowly realized that, oh, in fact, my curiosity and my energy over finding that truth actually is part of what is being made manifest in the text and is drawing people into it. That is to say that people can kind of tell, even if they don't know, if you're just telling a story for their benefit versus when you actually believe it yourself, when you're actually there and you're on. So that is to say that, like, it all had to be, you know, organic. Like everything has to, like, I really have to want to, you know, it has to originate in a place of deep, you know, curiosity. And where the case for reparations begins in terms of Israel, which is something I call, and I can't remember whether I put this in the book, but I certainly said, just this kind of latent default Zionism that existed in the world that I was in. It is not so insidious as to be ever even really spoken. It is not so insidious as it to be the case that people explicitly say, and I'm talking about my personal experience right here. I'm not saying this doesn't happen, but I'm talking about my personal experience, where it's said that, you know, you can't go certain places, you can't say certain things. It's just that they're basic beliefs. Of course Israel's good. Of course it is. Don't you know what happened to the Jewish people in Europe? Aren't you happy that they finally have a country where they can be at home and, you know, be free after, you know, 2 millennia of oppression and persecution and genocide and pogroms? Who could be against that? Why would you ever be against that? And it, because everyone else around you, at least vocally, feels that way, it becomes very easy to just sort of slide in, you know, to that story. And that was about where I was with the case for reparations. It was even more complicated for me, and I'm sorry this is taking a long time, but it's actually a complicated thing, because I grew up around people who were themselves part of a radical tradition in the Black movement. And these were not people who had ever been to Palestine. These were not people who could look at a map and say, this is where Gaza is, this is where the West Bank is, this is the policy here, this is the policy. Like, they didn't have that kind of, you know, acuity or knowledge, or could make an argument with you about, you know, apartheid, and maybe you can't even to this day. But what they could do, and I remember this, you know, so clearly as a child, I would be sitting at home, and my dad would come home and he would watch the nightly news, and he would look and he would say, the Israelis are white and the Palestinians are Black, right? Now, obviously, that's not the most sophisticated analysis. It's also not an unwise analysis, though. And so what happens in journalism is we, at least in that period, are taught to privilege a kind of intelligence over wisdom, over people that just kind of, you know, have a moral sense of what is right and what is wrong. You know, and there's this belief that somehow a list of facts can somehow be stronger than what is right and what is wrong. And this has been made manifest all through my press, by the way. You know, but there are people who really, really believe that. Okay, so I say, that I think what I thought was, I am going into this place, which I know is kind of compromised, but they have tools that I need. I will go in there, I will get the tools, and I will do the liberatory thing. I will speak the words of liberation, case for reparations. But anytime you go in alone, you're already compromised, even if you don't know it. And so Case for Reparations came out. I had this huge dream, you know what I mean? I would say this thing that could not be said in this place, but I would do it with the great machinery of this magazine, of journalism, and I would have all those resources directed at this thing that my people had never been able to say. And, you know, of course, along the way, I stepped on somebody else. This was made evident to me probably about a week after it came out. It did not take long. It didn't take long. And there's a gentleman by the name who's down at actually Johns Hopkins now, who, you know, wrote, "Wow, this is a great article. Glad he did this, but this Palestine stuff is really bad." And I was like, And then, you know, as I've, you know, said publicly, you know, we had, you know, the event at Sixth and I, a young lady got up, you know, yelled about it. And I want to take you back to where this story began, which is that this idea of curiosity. So I can't speak for most people, but it's kind of my responsibility to say, why is this person in a synagogue yelling at me? You know, like, it's kind of my responsibility to not say, clearly this is somebody who's crazy and I go on with my life. That was 2014. And, you know, sometimes it takes 10 years to answer a question. But here we are now, and this is the answer.
So I remember, so for folks, for the young people who have not read it yet, The Case for Reparation makes its models for reparations on one of the only forms of accountability that has actually been exacted internationally, which is the reparations for survivors of the Holocaust in Germany, right? But in doing that, that's why.
And to be clear, reparations to the state of Israel. Mm-hmm. So not just to like individual survivors, but to the state.
Idea project. Yeah. Exactly. In the way that Robin Kelly describes, like, what reparations could have been in providing for institutions as opposed to individuals. And so the young woman who was screaming at you at the time, you all might know her, Rania Khaled, who's a journalist for BT News, right? So it's all like this very close system, and then it takes you to Palestine.
She wasn't really screaming, so I don't want to make her sound like hysterical, but she was making a very forceful point. That's probably a better way. Because the way, you know, you kind of hystericize people, and it's like,
that's right. I think that's exactly right.
I don't want to, like, she went like out of control. She wasn't like, I don't want to make her sound.
She was kind of in the Palestinian. She's not Palestinian, but she was in the Palestinian tradition of disruption. Like, that's what Palestinians do.
But you know, it wasn't. It was like a Q&A. Like, that was the other thing. She didn't, like, stand up in the middle.
So she didn't even.
No. It was a Q&A.
Okay.
Well, she's very aggressive in the Q&A. As it should have been. I'm not. Like, I'm trying to make sure that I don't make her sound insane. You understand? Like, there's a way you can see that.
She was very brave to have done it where she did it. No.
She was extremely brave.
But glad we clarified.
Yeah.
But you say, it's so funny because you talk about the moral wisdom that your father and his generation imparted on you. And one of the things I've said often to Ta-Nehisi is that he's mapped out for us a moral cartography. Very much in reading this book, and I've seen it, right, where you will not be moved because you know what's right and wrong. And in fact, there was a line, if I can read from this place where you tell us in Palestine, quote, "Race is a species of power and nothing else." And I knew here in this moment how I would have fallen in the hierarchy of power if I had told that black soldier that I was a Muslim. For as sure as my ancestors were born into a country where none of them was equal to of any white man, Israel was revealing itself to be a country where no Palestinian is ever the equal of any Jewish person anywhere, end quote. It's very clear, and it's actually very true. It's very true as people who study it and know that there's a global dimension to this. And yet what we've seen over and over is that folks want to question your morality and even demand an exception of it. And do it by insisting that you might not know enough. You don't have that master's in Middle East studies to say it. How do you respond to the folks who are asking for an exception in morality?
I won't say it's been pleasing, but it's been good. Mm. Because I thought I knew who I was talking to, and now I really do. And they don't even realize this. Like, people tell on themselves, and they don't realize they're telling on themselves. So they say, well, you know, Hamas did this, the Palestinians did that. What about this? What about that? And to them, that makes it, that allows them to accept this form of apartheid from all others. Because in their mind, like, Black folks were enslaved, and there was no story behind what Black people had done. Jim Crow happened, and there was no story behind what Black people were doing. But what they don't realize is, like, part of talking to a descendant of those systems is not just, like, a kind of emotional feeling, but it's an understanding of, like, the stories your parents and your grandparents told you. So you know full well that, like, when somebody says, yes, but what about what the Palestinians are doing, or yes, what about terrorism, or just I'm afraid, you know that during segregation, like, they were like, yes, but what about the crime rates? Like, there's always a because. So it's, like, not an exception. It's, like, actually not an exception at all. It's just the language of apartheid. It's no different. It's no different. It's not, wow, I never thought about that. Why is this a little different? Because, no, this is the language. This is the, and that, you know, just if we go back to what I was saying before, it's like people never do things without making an argument or a narrative. You are constructing a narrative for why it is right for you to hold half a population, you know, at a level below yourself, why that's okay. But everybody does that whenever they want to exploit somebody. This is not new. So it's like, oh, I understand. I used to read all of these books, and I used to say, wow, who could be the person that could actually argue for segregation? Who could be the person that could actually argue? I'm talking to him. I'm talking to him right now. You know? And so that is, it's been good, because it's drawing these bright lines for me. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, oh, okay, you would have been that person. Oh, if I was over there, you would be that person too. Like, that's who you are. It just so happens that at this point in history, I am here. And that gives me certain privileges in my conversation with you. But if this was another point in history, our relationship would be very, very different. So it's actually been good.
Yeah, no, you welcome the, I've heard you say that. I want to get to the fight, but I want to get to you in Palestine.
Yeah.
Because even in the same statement, you in Palestine, your Blackness is not read in the same way. And yet your religion would have been policed differently. Mm-hmm. Right? And so you're also telling us a story about racism.
Yeah.
And how we can't project our American racism onto the world, but racism exists elsewhere. Right? Right?
Yeah.
And so can you tell us about that, the witnessing and then coming together and kind of how you start to catalog, you know, and maybe even what your father said doesn't get troubled in the morality of it, but what you're seeing might trouble it. Because it's not coding in the same way.
Yeah, but you know, like a generous, and I think actually correct interpretation of him when he said these people are Black, these people are white. It's not literally these people are from Europe, these people are from Africa. It is, like, he's making a to your point about race being a species of power, he's making a power analysis based off of what he, you know, knows through his life experience. Mm-hmm. That's the wisdom in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but you are correct. I mean, in the facts of it, it's very difficult. And I'll be honest with you, I suspect we kind of saw this in the election a little bit. It's very difficult, and maybe, you know, we see this with Zionism, as I think about it. It is very difficult for a group of people who core to their identity is that they exist on the lowest socioeconomic rung in a society and have, as long as that society has been existing, to go out into the world and see that there are places where that's not necessarily the case. And yet those places also too, you know, as you've written, have their version of white supremacy. Mm-hmm. So it is global still. It's just not, you know, refracted in the same way. And in the same, you know, I you know, we talked about this. I spent some time in France, and this is like the first time I actually encountered this. I'm not going to say that they love Black Africans there. But they really, really hate Africans from the Maghreb in a different kind of way. Like, in a very, very, and it's, you know, of course, it's, you know, historical. Once you know the history, you understand why they do. You know, but what I'm saying is, like, the level of intensity is different. And even though, like, we say to ourselves, and we've had this religion, you know, I know have a race being a social construct. When you see it, it's shocking. Like, and it takes a moment. Like, it's like, destabilizing for a second, you know what I mean? To watch racism play out, as I did for those 10 days, and as I had in other countries, but damn, because it was so intense. But to like almost be a bystander to it, like to just kind of watch it flash right in front of you, is deeply, deeply disorienting. I wrote that book, but I still have not found the words or processed what that means. You know, I also think, you know, it's one of the reasons why you try to explain it to people, but if they don't see it and they don't experience it, they don't quite get it. You know what I mean? Because it's like you kind of have to understand that the frame that you have been raised in, the frame that this country, you know, built itself on, is not a perfect match for what you're going to see over there. You know?
But you're not saying you have to see it in order to understand it.
I'm not saying you have to see it in order to understand it, but I'm saying when you see it, you understand it on a whole other level.
That's right. That's right.
You don't have to, but...
No, I think that's very vivid in the way that you write your, you know, in your writing. Yeah. We're walking with you. Yeah. We're seeing what privileges you would have been afforded and what you are afforded, right? Because you said you weren't Muslim, right? Because right? That's not going to be the marker for you.
Right.
Or the fact that you're in a different part of Jerusalem and you can feel in a different country, which is what you tell us. But I also really appreciate in life, but also in this book, your humility. That there's a recognition of the limitations of what you're doing as well. So you tell us very much, you get there and you see something, you know. You're familiar. You're familiar with the segregated roads. You're familiar with the inequality. You're familiar with the creation of difference and superiority and the logics of it. And so you can call it Jim Crow. It looks like Jim Crow, what we would have called apartheid had international law applied here. Yeah, that it was that. But you also limit that. You also then tell us it's more than Jim Crow. It's not just segregation of the water, but it's ownership of the water. So you start to wade into, well, what does colonization have to do with it? So I think in that, what I found so powerful was both the simultaneous power of the analogy and the recognition and its limits.
Yeah.
And its limits. So yeah, can you tell us more about both of those, but muse on the limits.
Well, I mean, the fact of the matter is, I mean, I was conscious the whole time. First of all, Nora is not giving herself the credit she deserves because she read an early version of this and gave critique. So part of the reason why that's there is because of her. And I'm not making that up. That's true. So thank you for that. I don't know if I publicly said that. Like, that's an unknown thing. I was writing this, and I was like, I have to write this because of the case for reparations. And I knew... God, I'm going to try to say this without sounding like an asshole. I am aware, and I was aware, that I have a certain profile as a writer. And I was aware that if I say certain things, you know, it'll be like a bomb going off. So I knew that the whole time. That didn't really scare me. And it obviously certainly didn't scare me into not doing it. But what I did feel and what I have felt and what I still feel is when I was writing Case for Reparations, I was writing Between the World and Me. This is mine. This is mine. Like, I own it. I got it. You know what I mean? This is my mother's, my grandma's, my grandma. Like, this is ours. I'm in the tradition. I'm on it. I know. That means I know everything, but I'm in my lane. I'm writing my story. I am writing extended memoir. And this is the first time in my life where I didn't have that. And you feel it. Like, you feel like, you know what I mean? Like, it's, and I'm not one of those people that feels that only certain people should tell certain stories, but I do feel. And when you're telling somebody else's story, there is a level of respect you need to have. And as some of us do not always have that respect, I very much do feel that. And so I guess part of what I feel in my heart is it's like, you know, in a just world, like I wouldn't even be telling this story. You know what I mean? And so I feel the injustice, even in the fact that I'm the person writing it. You know what I mean? Like, and so it's always like you're always just a little, you know, not quite at ease. You know, sometimes people say things to you during interviews and you got to check them. And it's like, am I supposed to check them here or should I? You know what I mean? And so, you know, it's not that you're afraid. It's like, is this the time? And you don't quite know because it's not yours. You know what I mean? And then, you know, you're also aware that how do I put this? On some level, I don't spend too much time thinking of what people are going to ultimately think of the book. At the same time, I am aware that I am writing, and this is very particular to the story, I am writing in the experience or about the experience of a group of people who, not just victims of segregation, racism, isms, you know, oppression, but can't get the mic. Yes. That's a very specific thing. And now you had a mic. Like, you had the mic. And so it's like, you know, whether you want to speak for people or not, this is the fact of what it is. You know, and so that has been uncomfortable. You're going to get things wrong. You would never say it the way, you know, the folks who have spent generations and who have ancestry with it and the wisdom of ancestry would say, you will never have access to that. You know what I mean? And part of, if there was any, you know, courage in this book to the extent that it was not the fact of, you know, going to mainstream media and saying what it is. That is easy. That's what journalists are supposed to do. That's what the job is. The courage is in understanding you are not the best one. You really aren't. You're just the one that showed up and the one that has the privilege right now. That's it. And that's the hardest part. That is by far the hardest part for me.
Yeah, also I'm just gonna say like thank you, because a lot of people have the mic and haven't used it.
Yeah.
You know, wait.
It really is the bare minimum.
I appreciate that.
No, it really is. I believe that. I'm not, you know, this is not like false humor. I really believe that. Journalism is supposed to have at its root like this. And I know it doesn't. And, you know, like maybe I'm like a romantic. I am. I'm naive and I'm romantic. I get it. Okay. So feel free to disregard what I'm about to say. But it is supposed to have like this root of like, I mean, they say it, you know, speaking truth to power, justice, all of that, you know, and again, as a black writer, as a black journalist, that is the tradition that we come out of. That's what we're supposed to do. I don't know if I put this in the book, but my buddy Eve, who I went, you know, to Palestine with, like a week before we went, she was like, Ta-Nehisi, I'm scared. I was like, yeah, I'm scared too. You know, and not scared like something's going to happen to me, but I know I don't think what I'm going to see is going to be great. You know, and I had to tell everybody it's not great. And things she said is like, right, but Frederick Douglass like published these memoirs, and at any moment somebody could have dragged him out of a seat like I'm sitting in right now and sold him back into slavery. Would have been fine. You know, Ida B. Wells like went down south and, you know what I mean, investigated these, whatever, you know what I mean? After having been run out of Memphis, exile, you know what I'm saying? Walter White, you know, the past for White, literally, not to bring it bad, Walter White. OG Walter White. You know what I mean? He was braver than, you know, that Walter White ever could have been. You know, he's passing for white investigating. If they had found out who he was, I mean, what they would have done to him? And so here we are talking about being afraid. You know, it's the minimum. This is the minimum, you know, for any of us. So I appreciate that, but it's what's supposed to happen.
No, I appreciate that because you also, look, and we're here in a university. You describe the willing intellectual.
Yeah.
As a category. Right. Not only of the journalist who's not speaking, but also of the willing intellectual who perpetuates stories. Yeah. In fact, my colleague, Maya McDashi, has pointed out several times that, I don't know, that like our university has been asking us to counter knowledge production. To decry what the ICJ jurisprudence has been telling us. Like, it's the opposite of willing. It's coercing intellectuals to do the opposite. But let's just speak plainly here, since this is a rare opportunity. Y'all saw the interview with Ta-Nehisi on CBS?
Yes.
Yeah. That was fun to watch. you know, and all of us in watching this, I think, recognize the same thing, which was just the absolute whiteness of trying to scold you and tell you that you don't know better.
Yeah.
And that let me put you in your place in this moment and make sure that nobody else gets to speak. Like, I think all of us recognize that, right? But we also recognize that it was very racist towards you. And one of the things I told Ta-Nehisi offline was, you know, first of all, power to you. And forget this guy, right? But I also said, you know, that's been the experience of every Palestinian who's gone on any program. Like, just, but nobody recognizes it as racist. And it connects to what you've been saying repeatedly, which is the pushing of Palestinians out the frame so thoroughly that we can't even recognize how racist that is. And you know that because of the newsrooms you've been in, and you know that because of the people that you meet and talk about. So can you tell us about that frame and how it's set?
Yeah, I mean, I think it goes back, you know, again, to we talking about case for reparations. Why is there a default Zionism there? You know, why is there not a default global anti-apartheid feeling there?
Mm-hmm.
And the question becomes, who is in the newsroom? You know, is there anybody in there who would have articulated a global anti-apartheid, you know, feeling that would have went beyond just America and South Africa? No, there wasn't. It wasn't. And so, like, this is what I was saying about, like, when you go into a place and you're alone. I was, for the vast majority of my time, though not by the end, but by the vast majority of my time at DLN, I was the only Black writer on staff there. You know, like, I was the only Black person in the newsroom. And as you can imagine, it was not the case that I was only the only Black person and thus surrounded by other people of color. I was not. There were no Palestinians there, no Arab Americans there. I am sure, you know, it's an interesting thing. I try to remember who have I worked around. Well, there was an Iranian American intern when I was at Time. And that's about all I can remember. That's about all I can. Now look, you know, part of that might be on me, like who I saw and who I did not see, but I'm sure that if we ran the numbers, folks are not represented. And I want to use that word in a very careful way, because there's a way in which representation becomes co-opted, or we need to be diverse, we need to be this. But I'll just talk about my field. In the production of news, in the production of stories, diversity is extremely important. Like, and it's like literally important. It's not a favor. It's not a nice thing you do to someone. You cannot tell the stories without, as hokey as this sounds, ancestral wisdom. The person who has heard the story from their grandfather, from their grandmother, from their great-grandparents, the person who has lived it, they just know more. They just, you know what I mean? They have soaked it in a way that you cannot soak it in by deciding you're going to read, you know, a few articles. There was every, you know, few years or so, and I'm sure we're about to go into it again. In the world of journalism, it becomes, and particularly opinion journalism, it becomes time to talk about whether Black people are naturally intellectually inferior to white people or not. And this inevitably gets some sort of respectable hearing in some sort of publication. And this happened, you know, many, many years ago. I mean, it happens all the time, but the instance I'm thinking of, it happened at Slate. And the guy wrote this whole thing about how Black people were inferior. And then, of course, he got outed. All of his sources came from one paper. The one paper was this guy who was this complete white supremacist, and then he had to apologize, right? And it's like, brother, if you had a couple of editors
right.
who were steep, they would have told you.
Right.
They would have said, why are you reading this? So it's like, there's a Western idea, if I may be so broad, of the writer. And this is what I'm kind of in war against, honestly. As the writer, as this figure that sits on a mountaintop up here,
mm-hmm.
and they dispense wisdom. They just dispense it out. And it's just them by themselves. They've read so much. They've studied so much. They've seen so much. And they will dispense it. It is not a communal model. It's not, you know what I mean? Well, I'm thinking about what my dad said. It's not, you know what I mean? I sent this to, you know, I handed it to my wife to read to get her playback on it. It's not this comes out of, you know, a heritage, a series of stories that I've been hearing all my. No, this comes out of me sitting, you know, in my easy chair and reading a few studies that somebody sent me. And because I'm so smart, that now makes me, you know, qualified to opine, you know what I mean, and weigh in. And so, like, that's a model, you know? And it's one in which when people see you coming, like, they think that's who you are. And so, I show up on CBS, and it's like, oh, you just went somewhere for a couple days, and then you came back and did X, Y, and Z. You know, like you think that my way of writing and my way of study is your way of writing and study. And that's really where the mistake is. You know what I mean? Like that is what that was. I mean, I you know, First of all, I'm sorry for y'all about that interview, because it actually wasn't that bad for me, but I'm sorry for you guys. For me, it was good. It was good. It was good because let's speak plainly, as you say. Let's speak plainly. This is how you feel. Let's say it. Take the awards. Take everything. And then let's talk because I'm not the awards. You know what I mean? I'm not the honors. That's not, you know, who I am. At the end of the day, you still got to talk to me. You know what I mean? And I have, you know, done the reading. I've talked to people. I've been places. And either you are going to defend this as something that should be done to people, or you're not. It's a simple question. So really, like, you can't, you know, there are no PhDs or masters or JDs that you're going to get that are going to make this any more profound than it is. Mm-hmm. You know, some things in life are simple. Inhale oxygen, exhale carbon dioxide. That's what it is. It's just that. It's just that. And so I just think, like, we become enthralled with, like, this kind of particular form of knowledge. And folks think that, you know, gives them the ability to say certain things. It's okay.
Well, I'm glad we saw the interview. I thought that the interview was really instructive. I thought it did say a lot. It was really instructive. And it sold your book a lot more, too, actually. I have two more questions. So if there are cards coming around, if they can come my way, my last two questions. Because, you know, Ta-Nehisi, we keep talking about what you saw, and we're not getting into what you saw. And I kind of want you to speak on it. I mean, you call
now it's
it
time
a
for the Q&A. There are four
report.
Questions that were asked of Edward Said. The first one
on
is,
as well.
What are the commonalities that can,
like,
unite us?
Hundreds, even thousands of pages of documentation and da-da-da-da-da, you still have people telling you, but no, it's not the same and it's not that. It's not the same and it's not that. And that's the exceptional part. So maybe if you could tell us, what is it about what you saw that makes it unequivocal? There should be no, but there was no exception.
Yeah, I mean, I understand what you're saying about exception, but it just sounds familiar to me. Like, it just sounds like echo to me. You know, one of the things is, I think, like, the thing we have to get to is, see, the thing is, Palestine is right now, it's happening right now. And so that can kind of be distortive because you can never truly capture a historical moment. But what I am trying to say is there is always denialism about oppression. It's partial to it. Like the system does not just do the thing. The system must always justify the thing too. Mm-hmm. You know, there's what is the name of that book? Anyway, it was actually when I was working on just an article about Trump years ago, and I read this book, and the dude, you know, is making a case about how folks justified slavery. And there's this guy who claims to be this, you know, against slavery. He says, yeah, I was against black slavery until I realized we had white slavery in the North. And, like, that is just like, oh, you know, this is better than, you know, the working. I mean, this was a whole argument, though, that, in fact, the way capitalism enslaved labor, you know what I mean, in the North, enslaved labor in the North, actually slave labor in the South was better. I mean, it's an argument people made and took seriously in the time to justify slavery, which sounds absurd now. But it's been, like, revealing. Like, I feel like I was, in this way, I feel like it is mine, and I was trained for it. Because I see it, and I say, oh, I know exactly what that is. You know what I mean? And so I think one of the problems is, if you saw this clearly, you said, listen, you talk about the roads, you talk about the license plates, you can talk about the water, you can talk about the housing permits, you can talk about the laws around marriage, you can talk about the laws around citizenship, you can talk about all of that and only be scratching the surface of how bad it is and how bad this is. But if people had to admit that, it would be such a disruption in American policy. Like, so much would have to change that you almost have to lie about it. Because if you saw the thing squarely, I mean, what? Like, if I told you straight up, like, if we had to, and I don't mean we in this room or we on this Zoom, but if we had to honestly accept that we go around the world and tell people that part of our legacy, part of the greatness of America is that it threw off slavery, is that, you know, it accepted the, this is the story to tell, is that it accepted the wisdom of Martin Luther King and that, you know, and making our democracy strong, and we're always improving and we're better now than we were before. While we are perpetrating and funding apartheid through an instrument of genocide right now at this very hour, that all of the international organizations, you know, as troubled as these reports might be and as critiqued as they probably should be, at the end of the day, it is very, very clear what's happening. I mean, you don't really have the electoral politics yet that's set up to accept that as fact. Right. You know, and so the denial almost has to happen. You know what I mean? It doesn't mean you don't, you know, say what you have to say, but I just, that was what was so hard about it. Like, I came back and I just, you know, I've told this story before, but I came back. I saw things that I took video of because I knew I was going to disbelieve them when I got back and feel like I remembered it wrong, took pictures, all of that. And I get back and, you know, I wrote Rashid Khalidi up at Columbia and I said, hey, you don't know me, but, you know, I just got back and I, you know what I mean? Like, some of what I saw, and then I was like feeling all the feelings I felt about case reparations. And I, you know, he had me and my wife over for dinner and it was just a room full of people that just said, you did see what you saw. Mm-hmm. Like, even at that moment, I was like, I couldn't have saw what I saw. Like, this can't be true, you know? And it just takes a lot. I think this is really bad, man. This is like, even for those who are like critics, you know what I mean? Of America and how it tells us, like, this is, I don't want to categorize things, but I just, this is bad. This is bad on a level that I don't think I could have reckoned with before I went at all.
I think the reason that I keep asking for exception is because people might recognize it as bad, but also recognize it as necessary. Mm. As necessary for that first story of how to atone for the Jewish Holocaust, right? And so see it as necessary.
Yeah.
And so that's why I go there, because folks get stuck of like, this is necessary, even if it costs this much. But what it comes down to is what you were telling me just right before now, right? When somebody was asking about whether President Biden, does he think Palestinians are equal? Does he feel that they have as much of a normal life to return to? And the answer was
no.
No, so it's bad, but not recognized when you can't recognize that who it's happening to are worthy.
But Nora, isn't that the essence of it? Like, isn't it always like that when the thing is happening?
100%. 100%. I don't know if you all saw this, but if you were on the social media yesterday, there was a story that went around of a young boy, 14-year-old Ayham Salama. I don't know if you saw this. And it was a 14-year-old boy who's been sentenced to a year in prison. Military prison where there's a 99% conviction rate, right? And yet, democracy. And his father, for 12 months, he's gonna be locked up for throwing stones. And his father is basically telling him how to survive in that time. And we saw that video. Now, what was so striking to me is that we see it in this moment of ongoing genocide. But that is the condition of being Palestinian, well preceding. Almost, it is our natural condition to constantly, and so many Palestinians know the condition of incarceration for that reason. And with, this doesn't count as one of my questions, by the way. But you're writing this in the moment of genocide, but you could have written this any other time. Because what you're seeing precedes this moment where all of us, more of us are paying attention. Like that part of what is it? Does it change because of the moment that you're writing in? Does it make it more imperative? Are you writing faster? Is it more urgent? Does it change your analysis?
Yeah, I would have taken more time. Like, honestly, what I felt like as I got deep into this, and part of because of what I was talking about, the whole privilege thing and knowing it's not your story. I mean, I wanted to take another year. You know, in fact, my whole plan was I went and saw what I saw and I was like, okay. I'm not going to say anything about this. I'm going to write this book, and then I will do it then. And then, of course, October 7th happens, and, you know, you have to act that, and it becomes, okay, you can't wait. You know? Yeah. And so and I wrestled with that a little bit because if it were up to me, this book would not have come out. If it were up to the writer part of me, the part of me that, you know, wants to, you know, just sat, like, because I wasn't done. Like, I wasn't done. I wanted to know more. I wanted to, you know, I mean, Palestine could have taken over that entire book. You know, I probably would have let it, you know, if left to me, you know. But I was not done, you know. And maybe you're never done, but I felt like I felt strongly I was not done. You know, I had a stack of books I hadn't read yet. I had, you know, reports I hadn't read yet. I wanted to go back. I wanted, and there was so much more. You know, I was trying to when I was over there during those 10 days, I was trying to get into Gaza at the time, but I had no press affiliation. Mm-hmm. I got my press affiliation, and I was, Jesus Christ, trying to go back in the fall.
Oh, yeah.
Before this, before obviously. But I was, you know, like, I was, like, I wanted to know, because the thing is, once you see it, I was there for that time, and by day five, I was like, my God, when am I going home? You know, and I was counting down the days, and then the plane took off, and I got here, and I was home for a couple days, and I was like, when are we going back? You know? And so I just wasn't done. I wasn't done. I wasn't ready. You know, it's incomplete. The book's incomplete. You know what I mean? And I know that, and I feel that, you know, I'm very proud of the book.
As you should be.
But it's not like I was like, aha, here's the solution. I got it. Here you go. You know?
Well, obviously, we're all going to benefit as you continue to explore and continue to write. And I do hope that we all get to go and we all get to visit Gaza, a flourishing part of a complete Palestine without militarized borders, and with a shore that children can play in and fishermen can see in, can fish in. And where there's ramps for the able-bodied and the disabled-bodied and so many who have been maimed in this moment. So I wish that for all of us, my intention. But let me end on a place where we are, and something that's relevant to us in this room, and to all of us, right? So boycott is also a rich part of the Black freedom tradition.
Yeah.
And a part that's exalted and celebrated. As being, you know, this is the model of nonviolence, in fact, right, that's exalted. And yet, Palestinians who have participated in boycott and asked others to participate in boycott, divestment, and sanctions with them are maligned. Even, like, what's so frustrating, and I know for the other Palestinians in the room, people think that your boycott isn't even about you and your people's freedom, right? It's weaponized into how much you hate somebody else. Nothing that we do is about ourselves, right? There's a way that that becomes abstracted. So I would love for you to comment on boycott, because a lot of us in this room now have the opportunity to participate it here on this campus as part of actually a union vote that started today.
Can you tell me more?
Sure. So the Rutgers Union, open to the students and the faculty, are voting on a resolution on divestment from arms industries that are profiting from industries, you know, in the words of Ruth Wilson Gilmore, industry of life-shortening, life-threatening industries. They're profiting from apartheid. They're profiting from another day of genocide. And we have the opportunity as a union, right, to vote to divest from those industries at this university.
Yeah, I mean, one of the frustrating things for me about the response and the coverage was how it became about, for lack of a better term, like manners.
Mm-hmm.
These people aren't saying things the right way. They aren't, like, it's like, and they do this again, like, you start to see the lines. Like, this happened with Black Lives Matter too, where it's like, you guys don't look like Dr. King looks, so therefore, and if you did, I would be for you.
Right.
When you weren't for King in his time.
Anyway.
It's not like that's what the history was. This was not, like, the sit-ins were not popular. We were not like, wow, they're so well-dressed, we will listen to them. That's not what happened. You know, and so, like, people kind of lie because they don't want to talk about the thing. And so they talk about how you talk about the thing, you know what I mean? Instead of, you know, actually going to it. And I say that to say that, like, one of the frustrating things was, it's like, you know, that university's building a Tel Aviv campus that Palestinian students, not that they would want to, but cannot attend.
Mm-hmm.
So you are aiding and abetting in discrimination.
Period.
Like, as a university, like, you are practicing, at the most conservative case I can make, you are aiding discrimination, which is probably something much worse. Why is that okay? Again, like what? Like, why? Like, and so, like, and I'm not, like the boycott thing is obviously true and correct, but it's also, like, It's not just your reaction. It is the action that is being taken. In other words, you are not acting against a passive thing. Mm-hmm. The thing is doing something. It is doing something that is immoral. It is doing something that is wrong. I mean, to me, this is just an extension of like how I felt when I came back, and I guess when I was there. Because you see the segregation and you say, oh, this is us. This is not just I visited somewhere and I saw something horrible and I was against it because I have a moral code. This is I went somewhere, I saw something, and I am responsible for it. I am the subsidizer of it. You know, and so just as I, you know, have deep questions and deep criticisms, you know, for the idea that America should subsidize apartheid, it makes sense that anybody that is part of any institution that is also subsidizing apartheid would have deep questions about that. And the question is not like, why do you want to boycott or why do you have deep questions? It is, why is it that the people who oppose you do not have deep questions themselves? That is the real thing. I mean, and this is like, your reality can become distorted, and that which looks radical is in fact a sensible and moral thing. And the only reason why it looks radical is because some people have more power than other people. Part of power is making yourself look sensible, making yourself look logical, making yourself look like, oh, of course this is the way the world is. It's the natural order. Why wouldn't we? You know, and I don't know. I mean, that's one of the things I didn't get to, by the way. Like, that was like one, like, I was like, you know, like in terms of my exploration, because, you know, it was, I was listening to an interview one time and they were asking this guy, just on this podcast, and the guy wasn't even particularly sympathetic, you know, to Palestine or Palestinians, but, you know, they were, you know, doing this kind of nonviolent thing that they do. And the guy said, well, BDS, isn't this nonviolent? And the dude said, BDS seeks to destroy Israel, so therefore it's not nonviolent. Mm-hmm. But here's the insight, though. King's enemies understood him as trying to destroy America. Mm-hmm. And in some sense, he was. He was. Their belief in what America was, yes, he was trying to destroy it. It's correct. It is correct. You know what I mean? Like, to them, America was a white, and that's it. That's it. And so, yes, he was trying to destroy that. And so, you know, in so many ways, you know, the echoes of the past are right there. It does not look foreign. It does not look different. It does not look exceptional to me. You know, I take your point about, you know, how people position it as an exception. But it's not. It's not. It's just the same thing again, you know?
I'm with that. I'm here for it. I also, you know, it's so, Mark Lawn Hill does an annual MLK day, and one of the things that he emphasizes every year is MLK was an enemy of the state.
Yes, he was. Literally.
And was assassinated.
Literally, being an enemy of the state.
And yet what we do in to, you know, recreate that legacy. And so perhaps that's a legacy to be a part of.
Yeah.
And it's a moral duty. I appreciate that. I also misquoted, Gilmore. It's death-making industry, just so that we're fair to her. I'm ready to ask questions, y'all, your questions. So first of all, thank you to you for answering mine.
Thank you.